greetings to you all. I like to think of Insight Myanmar Podcast as a community platform. This community includes everyone behind the production, as well as the incredible guests that we welcome on. And it also encompasses the tens of thousands of listeners, like yourself, tuning in from all parts of the world. In essence, this production is a conversation that, really, we're all part of. So whether we're the ones who happen to be talking, listening, asking questions, or just reflecting, we hope that this community feel can foster deeper understanding, shared learning, and meaningful connections, all centered around the stories and experiences of our guests. And that begins with the conversation coming up now. So thank you for joining us for what's ahead.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to our Inside Myanmar podcast. I will be your host today, and my name is E. Sorry for my little bit of nasally voice. I'm just getting over a flu, but I'm really excited to welcome our guest for today, Jack Bazino. He is the author of a new book, Breaking the Cycle.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm a longtime listener of Inside Myanmar, so I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. It's always really nice to have our listeners on our podcast as well. So a little bit about the book, Breaking the Cycle. If you could just describe the book to our listener. I've read it and I really love it. And I want to hear your description of the book first.
Thank you. At first, it started as an adventure novel, but I think that now it's probably there's still an adventure part, but there's also an historical part since it's in two. You have two stories, basically two plots. The first one is taking place in 1942 during the Japanese invasion of Burma. And the second part is taking place in 2024 during the Spring Revolution in Chin State, but I mean, actually in the whole country. So the stories, the two plots are linked by a plane that crashed in 1942. And the idea is to have an object, an artifact, that is leading to historical relics, sacred relics of the Buddha in Suvarnabhumi. And the hunt for these relics starts in 1942, but they have to stop the search because of the invasion. And it continues in 2024 because of the plane crash and the fact that someone finds the artifact in the plane wreck. 82 years later. But more than an adventure novel, I think it's also something that is, I wanted to talk about the fight for freedom, democracy, and not only what's happening today with the Spring Revolution, but actually what started in the 1930s, the independence, and what was basically post during almost 7 decades or more since the coup of 1962. So for me, there's a direct line between the two, and in a way, the plane crash and this finding is the link between these two struggles for freedom and democracy in Myanmar.
The novel ties together between the 1942 around the World War II time and also the 2024 Spring Revolution. So it is a dual timeline epic. And it's I've actually never read something like this before. And it is rare to come across a creative writing piece for the current events happening, like the Spring Revolution. So it was very refreshing to read. And before we get into how you wrote about it and the story of it, I want our listeners to get to know more about you first. So I want to ask, like, did you live in Myanmar? How did the inspiration for this book started? How did the initial spark begin?
So yes, I lived in Myanmar for more than 10 years, but twice basically. I first came to Myanmar in 1998 as a student. I met my wife there. We came back to Yangon in 2001, and then back again in 2015 until the military coup. So I fell in love with Myanmar actually before going to the country, because I watched at the time when I was young Beyond Rangoon. It's really raised my interest. I didn't know anything at that time. I was still young about Myanmar, and I started to read everything I could find. So I chose to go there when I was a student, and since then, I everything that is Myanmar, I try to learn, to read, and I'm very passionate about the culture, the history, the country, and its people, of course. So this is my second book. The first book I wrote was on in French, and it was about Buddhism, but also Wayzas and this kind of esoterical beliefs. This one, I wanted to be more about the political sides of the history of Myanmar. And everything I love, I try to put into it, and everything I hope for also for Myanmar, I really put into the book, yes.
So from your experience living in Myanmar, were you there when the 2021 coup happened?
So yes, actually, I was in Yangon, in Saint-Jean. I woke up like everybody else without mobile network or internet. With my wife, we came also after the Saffron Revolution to Myanmar. We were there after Nargis, so we understood quite clearly what happened right away. And after that, yes, we stayed for a few months. And when the situation became very difficult, we decided to leave. So we were lucky because we have many friends and colleagues who couldn't leave. But now we're safe, and I find that we are very lucky indeed, yes.
Yeah, because you have to leave at 2021. And, you know, how did the research of this book was impacted by you not being there in person? I know that you have lived experience from the past 10 years in and out of the country, but a lot of the settings that you wrote about Spring Revolution in your book, it's very current, and it was set in Qin State. So the stories from the PDF, the protagonist, Kenyatta Nye, she's a woman in the PDF force, and her boyfriend, or like her friends, and then the people that she met, those are all set away from Yangon. So although you have lived experience, that is beyond your lived experience. So how did you get the research for your book?
I would say that this time for this novel, it was a bit easier than my first one, because the first one was partly taking place during the Saffron Revolution. And at that time, you didn't have social media in Myanmar, very few. And you had courageous people filming, taking pictures and sending everything abroad via human couriers. This time it was a bit, much easier actually, because you have everything documented on social media and in the press and in media. So there was what I knew about Myanmar from my personal experience, the Battle of Saint-Jean, the barricades, everything I could witness at that time in Yangon. And then for the rest, I mean, we have met people also, I mean, with my wife when we traveled in Thailand or neighboring countries, people who directly participated in some of the events that I describe. And at the same time, I have friends who are Chin who helped me with the Chin culture part and some aspects of what it is to be there in Chin state at that time. But of course, otherwise, it's listening to Inside podcasts, for example, Inside Myanmar. It's reading social media posts. You know, many people, individuals, they are sharing pictures, they are sharing experiences, testimonies. And of course, it's reading every day Myanmar media and reports. And there's a lot of information. And after that, it's mostly about putting everything back together to make sure it works with the plot and the story. Yes.
Yeah. Since the 2021 coup, there's a lot of I have seen a lot of studies and the research paper. And I used to work in the news media, so I still do, but I used to work for Voice of America. So the amount of information, the footage that we get, is the story is being told in more of a matter-of-fact way, but your novel, the story is being told in a creative writing format. Why did you choose to tell a story of Spring Revolution in this way? And what are the challenges that comes with it in terms of creative writing format? You already are an author, you have your first book, but in your mother tongue, French. So now it is written in English about a country that is a bit further away than our English-speaking audience. So two questions. The first is like, you know, how is it writing a creative writing format? And second, what are the challenges that come with it?
So first, I chose the creative format, I mean, fiction, for several reasons. The first one is because I like to write that. I think that's fiction, in a way, sometimes it's because it speaks to the emotions, like art in general. It's a good way to make people feel things in their flesh, in their hearts. This is what happened to me, basically, when I watched Beyond Rangoon and I started to be interested in Myanmar. So there are so many reports and articles already. I'm not a scholar, I'm not a researcher, I'm not an expert. So there are already so many people who are doing such a great work telling what's happening in Myanmar. I don't think I could add much to that. I don't have the pretenses to be an expert. But at the same time, I was very frustrated to see that even if Myanmar is the third most intense conflict in the world right now, basically nobody speaks about it, or only a few international media, a few nations who are close by. But if you go to Europe, if I talk to French people, and if you go even further to the United States, basically they don't hear about it. And I don't think that statistics and reports can change that. You know, there's a famous quote like saying something like, the death of one man is a catastrophe and the death of millions is just statistics. And I think that if people were interested, they could already have all the information they wanted to find about the 3 million displaced people, refugees, how many people died from bombing, how many rapes, and so on. But they don't connect. And I think it's because, it speaks to the reason and the mind, but doesn't speak to the heart. So I think fiction has this power to really get people emotionally involved. And this is why I chose that. So I hope that by, showing what, I mean, I try to show, I don't have the, I cannot pretend to know exactly what people feel on the ground, because I'm not a PDF fighter, I'm not a refugee, but by trying to put myself in their shoes and by trying to show what they may feel in terms of challenges, mental health, fear, and so on, the readers, they can connect with that and they will be more interested and they will bring some support basically to the country. So this is why I chose fiction. The challenge is, as I said, it's first, I'm not on the ground. I'm not a PDF fighter and I'm not a refugee. And so the challenge was to try to find the right voice try to find the right words to say and to show what these people may feel and what they are facing every day. And when you are not directly involved, it may be difficult to do that. And also, I didn't want to make it sound too, emotional in a way. I mean, I don't want to go into something that is too extreme and people will find it not realistic or like it will push them away. So it was very hard to find the right balance because it's very awful what's happening and people are facing impossible choices and impossible situations. And if you try to be too emotional, perhaps people will be pushed away by that. So it was difficult to find a way to write it, to show all this without while staying on a very thin line that people will engage with and feel concerned about. Yes.
Yeah, I felt that your descriptions were very strong, especially starting from the prologue about how the plane crashed, the details on how it happened, the atmosphere, the painting of it. I think your writing style is very descriptive. And for somebody who is more of a visual thinker, that has really helped me visualize being in the shoe of somebody who is on the ground. So I really enjoy that part of it. And if you don't mind, if you have an excerpt from the book that you would like to share with us, me and our listeners, that'd be great. And that would be a piece of your book that our listeners can try out before they read the whole book.
Sure. Thank you. Yes. So I would like to apologize in advance for my French accent, but I will do my best. So I will start reading. So the gun pressed into her back, heart. Metal against bone. She stumbled, her slippers sliding in the muddy soot covering the path. Pain sharpened her anger as her eyes locked on a carbonized figure smoldering in the ruins. The reek of burned flesh rose, sickening. Tears of fury carved pale lines on her darkened cheeks. Her parents, at Mindat, had suffered the same fate. Then anger turned to sorrow, mourning not only for her kin, but for her country, dismembered for decades. So much violence, so much blood. Why? So a few could cling to power? Small men with swollen egos, ready to ignite the world to quiet their fear and overcompensate their inadequacy. Me online, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, Donald Trump, Kim Jong-un, all different faces of the same disease corrupting mankind. That hunger for domination was alien to her. Had evolution rewarded the most violent? The struggle for control like atoms coveting an electron. For centuries, culture and law had tried to counterbalance that fall in vain. Cooperation, creation, other natural drives demanded such effort. Taking was easier. The universe moved towards entropy. Was human order doomed to the same unraveling? No, she was wrong. Despotism required constant energy, immense, exhausting, to sustain itself in its abnormality. A spring wound against nature, held tense through brute force. Freedom, on the other hand, was an instinct, a primal pulse. An ID reborn again and again, a dormant virus beneath the eyes of dictatorships revived with every spring. One day, the iron hand would tire. the cramp had already begun. The junta's reservoirs dwindled, weapons, repression, endless waves of broken men to keep it alive. But those men, she turned slightly toward the escorting soldiers. Another blow struck her heart. Sharp reminder. Poor, uneducated, despised, mistreated by their own officers. Buddhists, too. They were the same people, yet they'd chosen the executioner's side. Why? The banality of evil, she whispered, lips cracked by smoke and thirst. Hannah Arendt's words returned from an illegal pamphlet she had read secretly after the coup. But here, there were no Aryans with blue eyes lifted from a history book, no Nazi clerk with a spotless uniform signing deportation orders. The killers had familiar faces, men who offered flowers at the pagoda one day and then slit villagers' throats the next. No cold bureaucracy, only a proximity obscene and incomprehensible. Submission? Indoctrination? Yes. The generals' uniforms and nationalist propaganda replaced Milgram's white coats. Collective frenzy? Yes, that too. Group pressure turned to madness. How many obeyed from fear of falling? How many surrendered to the intoxication of power? The Tatmadaw offered them rifles and absolution, immunity, permission to abandon conscience. But could theory explain cruelty? Some must simply enjoy it. The memory of the rape rose again. Rage followed. Whatever reasons they claimed, there was no excuse. Each had made them a choice between deserter, watermelon, or sequoia. They had chosen, and they would pay in battle, by rope, or before churches. Or, if the monk was right, their karma would pursue them beyond the grave. Thunder rolled, and rain came in furious sheets, as if heaven itself strained to wash the desecration from the earth. Steam replaced smoke. Blood and ash drifted away in the water. The martyred hamlet froze in its gray mourning, a cemetery without names. King Adana raised her face to the sky, mouth open to drink this last offering to the condemned. Fear ebbed away with the rain streaming down her body. Only rage remained, alive, electric under the warm drops. Whatever awaited her, she would give them nothing. No surrender, no satisfaction. She was ready. That's it. Thank you.
Such powerful description. And especially the line that stayed with me was, the killer has familiar faces, donating flowers one day and slitting coats the next. I think that truly reflects how people who look like you and from the same background and same religion are still trying to dominate each other in our country and our endless civil war. So I get a bit emotional listening to you read out about the book. It's very descriptive in your nature, and the way you tie together the feelings of the protagonist and the reflection of the event, it's very powerful. From that, I want to talk about, I will give you a chance to say more about the excerpt that you just read out, if there's anything that you want to share with us.
I chose this part of the book because also I think that with what's happening today in the United States, it's resonating a lot with that because it's the same thing. Actually, you have different places, different eras, different cultures, but in the end, it's also there, the people with the same faces now, ICE people arresting and repressing. And also, this is why I'm sometimes very frustrated. It's because what's happening in Myanmar, I think, it's not only a local issue, Some people, sometimes they may think that, you know, it's Myanmar, it's been decades of fighting, and it's among Myanmar people, we are not concerned, and it's there's nothing we can learn from it. And actually, when you look at the maps, you can see first that Myanmar is on the front line, just like Ukraine is fighting Russia, but Myanmar in a way is fighting Russia too, and it's fighting China, so it's on the front line between democracies and autocracies around the world. And also Myanmar people, they have faced the same things that now Americans are facing. And still, we don't talk about Myanmar in the United States or in American media. And I think Americans could learn a lot about, you know, the way that Myanmar people organized. Every system that was put in place to support CDM people financially or hide them or help them to flee. The way that Gen Z and Myanmar people, PDF, they were inventive in fighting against repression without any support and without any material means. How they used internet and so on. And I think that now, with what's happening in Minneapolis and other places, Myanmar people actually have a lot to teach to U.S. citizens. Mm. Still, you know, I feel that sometimes developed countries, they think that they are the ones teaching and they don't have to learn anything from other countries. But I think that now it's the opposite. So this is why I chose also this this excerpt, because I think it resonates with what's happening in the U.S. right now.
Yeah, it shows relevance in current situation that's going on around the world and also in the United States. And there are some resistance going on in the United States as well, or like solidarity. A lot of U.S. citizens try to stand together with the people in the community who are being targeted by ICE, immigration, officers who try to come to, I guess like police, they come to their home and arrest them. I think recently in Minnesota, one Karen woman was taken from her home and her 5-month-old was left at the house with a dad who was, I think, exclusively breastfed up till that point. But since she was taken away, baby was struggling to take the bottle. That piece of news really broke me because I also just had a baby. My baby's 10 months old, and I cannot imagine being away from him, taking away like that. So there's a lot of, the good thing is there's a lot of solidarity to stand with the people who are being mistreated and in inhumane way. So people in the United States are resisting in their own ways, but the amount of resistance and the March of the Millions that we saw at the beginning of the aftermath of the 2021 coup was shocking to the rest of the world, the amount of people that came together to stand against unjust rule. So that kind of reality is something that we can all learn from each other. And I think the momentum is still there, although the international media, especially in America, is not always highlighting it. And from that, I want to ask you about, you know, since your scenes are very descriptive, I have two questions for you. And one of it is like, especially the war scenes, and there's a lot of violence in it, not just by the perpetrator, but also from the victim. And because you put yourself in their shoes and you write it, what are the most difficult scenes to write? And for me as a reader, it's sometimes I have to take a break because it's the war scene, and then also another scene about Aung San at executing somebody. Those kind of scenes, it seems a little bit bloody and also not something that we see in day-to-day life, but you describe it so well in detail. So but are they one of the most difficult scenes for you to write?
I would say that yes, of course, because the thing is, everything I wrote actually happened in a way. I mean, Aung San executing, it was the reason why Churchill wanted to arrest him for war crimes and so on after the independence. And other scenes, you know, basically, even if it's fiction, it's based on real accounts. And the difficulty is, I mean, what's happening is so violent. It's a reality. So the difficulty is actually to write about it in a way that shows that it's what people are facing and what they are living in their flesh, without doing it in a way that is, you know, voyeurism or gore or anything. I mean, I had similar, people telling, from my family and advanced readers telling me that it was very hard. But I didn't want also to write about the situation in Myanmar, the civil war and the war, and making it just an adventure novel. By making it like a Hollywood movie, you know, and not showing what's actually happening, because then people would not understand what it is to, when you have a school that is bombed or a hospital, when you have people being executed in villages. I mean, if you don't talk about that, it's very hard for people to understand what is happening in Myanmar. So that was part of the difficulty, yes, in terms of finding a balance, that, and of course, also, as I said before, the finding the right words to tell about the mindset of the characters. Again, because I'm not on the ground and I don't live that personally, but also because I didn't want to make it too emotional. So it's, yeah, I understand it's not an easy novel to read for some parts, but I think it's important. Just I was very marked when I was young because I read, for example, the book by Aung Noor, who was the actor playing in The Killing Fields, telling about his own story during the Red Khmer in Cambodia.
And that is hard to read.
Yes, exactly. And you have other, non-fiction books like this, and this is the reality. So perhaps it's not what we usually expect from a fiction book, but I understand that it's maybe hard, but I really wanted people to understand clearly what's happening in Myanmar now and why it's important to support its population. Yes.
Yeah, I noticed that you didn't like sensationalize the violence, or like you didn't make it more gory or more violent, more bloody for the entertainment purpose. And yet it is still very difficult to read. And I also, I'm not used to reading about war in the sense of a fiction novel about soldiers going into the jungle and all of that. When we were following one of your character, Anthony Preston, and his old buddies in the jungle, I seemed somewhat exhausted from reading their struggle. And I, as a reader, it makes me realize that, wow, I'm exhausted reading about it. Can you imagine somebody who's going through that, the exhaustion it would feel? And then on the flip side, when you talk about the parallel story about the modern day, after the 2021 coup, the PDF, People's Defense Force, and the fighters in the jungle trying to survive day to day, trying to get internet when they have Starlink connection, and also the frustration that women fighters feel by the least is like condescending comments from their colleagues, comrades, and then the worst is probably unreported sexual violence cases among comrades. Those frustrates me, and this is just me as like second, third person, not even in the exact same position, but as somebody who's reading about it, it seems exhausting to still be facing this kind of problem, that as a reader carry it from pages to pages. So that makes me sympathize with the characters more in how they must have felt living the reality of it.
Yes. I tried also not to give my characters, to be cliches in a way that I think that every character is in a way likable and not likable at the same time, because people are complex and they're all faced also with difficult choices. Some of them are more despicable of the as the others, of course. But even the heroes, they are facing difficulties, and they can be weak sometimes. They have their own mental issues and their own ideas, which sometimes are debatable and not acceptable even. And I wanted to show that the situation and the people are complex. So, for example, I'm, of course, supporting 100% the Spring Revolution. But as you mentioned, within the Spring Revolution, you also have problems. This is why I'm mentioning, for example, the issues between Qin groups. Even if my heroes are fighting with the Qin Brotherhood, I'm mentioning what happened and what is still happening, and basically the impact it has on the situation. If they were all united, probably Qin state would be already liberated, but they are fighting among themselves. The situation of women, of course, is very an important matter, because sometimes, unfortunately, I listened to the Inside podcast about it, when they say that people reject that as not being a priority right now, but actually it's very important, and it's a priority to prepare for the after revolution. So I didn't want it to be like bad versus evil and good guys versus the bad guys. It's more complex than that. But in the end, of course, there's a clear path. There's a clear light at the end of the tunnel. It's the everybody's fighting for the same cause, which is just. And so even if everybody's complex and they have their own problems, or not everything is perfect, the idea is hopefully that we'll manage to reach this goal. Yes.
Since we're on the topic of characters, let's talk about your main characters in your book and the archetype of people that they represent. So there is the protagonist, or the protagonist at the cover of your novel. It is, for our listeners, if I were to describe, it is the image of a woman. She is split in half. In one side, she has the PDF emblem on her arm in her camel outfit. And on the left side, it's in her chin. One said, longi and blouse, facing away from us, and the background is the jungle.
So I will try not to spoil the plot and the story, of course. But for the cover, there's that, but there's also actually the second layer, I would say, is that actually it's both Kenyadana, both sides, before and after the coup. But it's also on the left, it can be Nandae with her book, and on the right, Kinyanana, and the split in the middle is between, showing the two stories. You can see the plane still flying on the left side, so it's 1942, and on the right side is 2024. But there are different levels of reading for the cover. In terms of characters, Kinyarwanda, of course, the CDF fighter, CDF Mindat, but she's a doctor. So I didn't want her to be only a fighter, but she's on the ground, but she never fired against someone, but she's a doctor trying to help. You've got her friend, who is also a CDF fighter, a man. But in 1942, you have Anthony Preston, who is a young British, assistant archaeologist, trying to find to flee the Japanese invasion after finding a tablet, votive tablet in in the ruins of a stupa. You have his mentor, who is the professor Sayer. You have Nendai, who is a Burmese woman. And basically, there's a love triangle within the story of them fleeing the Japanese invasion. There's also the fact that they both love the same woman. Mm. And basically, that's it, yes. And of course, you have antagonists. But for 2024, basically, I would say that the antagonists, I mean, the bad people are the Tatmadaw in general. I didn't want to have one person, especially. It was more about the whole situation, I would say, is the enemy. You have sometimes nature, the jungle, the weather, the cyclone Yagi, I mean, typhoon Yagi, mm-hmm. in a way. So it's more like the situation in general and the army. They are all the antagonists. And she has, Kim Yanana, she has to basically fight against all these forces. And it's not personalized, specified in one person in particular. But in 1942, you have one Japanese officer who is basically hunting them, even if we don't really see it during the whole part of the book, but basically he's on their heel and trying to catch them to get the votive tablets. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed that like there's protagonists, the different characters, that all of them are protagonists in their own ways. And the antagonist, of course, the big bad wolf is the Denbro and the war. But also I see that each person has their own good and bad side, or like each character has it. And when I was reading it, I see that like the frustration between not to go too much into detail of the storyline before our listeners read it, but when the offsprings in UK found out the his old grandfather's relic was found by somebody on the ground in Chin State, the joy and the urgency that the grandson felt to recover this relic just so the old grandfather, who's turning over 100 on his deathbed before he died, could get to see this, his old work being recovered, versus the urgency of life and death situation that's going on the ground for the fighters and the people who are living in the current situation. I think you did an incredible job in trying to show the comparison without making it, without forcing people to see it. I think that description of it, and then the meeting point of how their paths are crossing and the level of urgency that they feel, I think is, as a reader, I truly enjoy that.
This tension, actually, I came out with it in a way because I felt frustrated, but also guilty in a way of, living abroad, and having a safe life and going on with my daily life and seeing around me people living safely also. And meanwhile, every day thinking about what's happening in Myanmar and what people have to face. And so there's a part of guilt, to be very honest, but there's also a frustration because when you try to explain to people who are not in Myanmar and they don't know the situation, what is actually the urgency? I mean, it's life or death. And compared to that, what we think is important when we live abroad in a safe environment, it's very menial. You know, I mean, it's actually not that important, but we make it very important. And it's taking a lot of place in our daily life. So I started with this idea. I wanted to show to basically put a mirror between what we live in Europe or in Western countries, what we think is very important. Our selfish needs and objectives and drives. And actually what is really important and what people in Myanmar have to face, which is staying alive, being safe, saving people who are, you know, refugees, living without food or medication, extra. So it's starting like that. And of course, I had to put it into the plot so that it came with the story about the characters and so on. So, that's why we have this great grandson of Anthony Preston and his own, how do you say that? His own objectives, which are very selfish in a way, and which are going in the way. He's not helping Kinyadana, actually, quite the opposite in a way, and just because he has his own selfish goals. Yes.
Yeah, I would say the character itself has not like a good and bad side, but also like I think it's very clear to me that what each character has in mind, what is important for them. I think you describe it very well in that situation. And, you know, because Kiyadana, the protagonist, is literally the woman written by a man, how do you make sure that the voices of the protagonist, a woman, is being heard? And also, you know, I noticed that there's like a theme of, like, I guess like a minor undertone of like women as like a moral compass during war. There's like the talk about the longi clothesline where the soldiers fear to pass. You include a lot of anecdotes about it. And because Kiyanana is also not a soldier, she takes on the softer part of it, which is like a nurturing character in there. She's a doctor. She's there to take care of the wounded. And although she's a protagonist, I feel like it's not as aggressive of as a protagonist as if, I don't know, like Indiana Jones in adventure novel. So what kind of decision did you make to include her in that way?
So, you know, it's quite strange because at first I did not really think about it. It came naturally when I started to think about the novel and the plots. I didn't think that, okay, I'm going to make her, I'm going to use a woman as a protagonist, etc. It came naturally for me. It seemed obvious. I think it's because, I've always been very impressed by the courage of Myanmar women. They were always at the front on the fights. The struggle for democracy, putting their lives at risk. Of course, the men do that too, but they face even harder challenges because they are women. The patriarchy, you know, when you have to, at home, women, and we know in Myanmar, they have to work harder than boys most of the times. They have also to, if they want to study, to work, they have to be very, to work harder than men. And in war, most of the times, they are the first victims, or at least they suffer more than men. So I don't know, it came naturally to me. And I think that after that, I wanted also to show that courage could be found in many different forms, and not necessarily, with a weapon. Of course, there are women fighting on the front line. But you can be courageous, you can contribute to the struggle, you can basically do a lot for the democracy and the struggle without having to fight. But my message is not that we shouldn't fight. I mean, our people shouldn't fight because I support the PDF and the armed struggle. There's no other way. But I wanted, there's a lot of violence already, as you mentioned in the book, about the war, etc. So I wanted to show that you can participate in war, you can be active, you can contribute, you can build something without having to fire a shot, actually. And I also think really that in a way, probably the world would be a more peaceful place if women were leading. I mean, I don't say there would then be any problems or issues, but I'm pretty sure there would be less wars. I mean, if you look at what's happening now in the world, it's basically old men clinging to power. In my excerpt, I mentioned them. I mean, it's Mianlin, Putin, Trump. Mm-hmm. These are old men scorching the earth just because they want to remain in power. And I mean, some women like Thatcher, etc., they, of course, they went to war, but it's a minority. And I'm pretty sure that the world would be a better place. Yes, indeed. So that's my point of view.
Yeah. I think the storyline, you know, I'm not going to spoil the ending, but I think it's quite optimistic. How as an author, right? Like you put yourself in different people's shoes and all these difficulty and challenges, and how can you maintain the tone of optimism despite all of the hardships that we see on the pages?
I don't know if it's wishful thinking, if I'm naive or not, but at the same time, you know, I mean, the situation on the ground, of course, right now it's very balanced, but still it's quite, I want to be optimistic. I mean, for the first time, you know, after 98, after 96, after the Saffron Revolution and so on, finally, I think that we came to a time when it can happen. The Tatmadaw may lose. It's possible. And now they are controlling less than half the country. So that's why I want to be optimistic. The problem is, of course, it's not, I mean, it's not the end of the world. The world. You have China pressuring ethnic groups, and I know there's a lack of ammunition for armed groups, so it's very tough right now. But I'm amazed by the ingenuity, of the Gen Z and all the fighters, what they managed to do in the jungle with very limited resources. So I really think, and I really hope, of course, that democracy can win. And I want this book I don't have to convince Myanmar people, I'm sure, but I would like other people who don't know about Myanmar, who are not certain, perhaps from outside, you know, you have conflicting articles, conflicting reports, you have analysts saying that the PDF cannot win, extra, even if now we are hearing this less and less, but still, you know, from outside, when people don't really know Myanmar, they may think that, oh, it's just going to be like before in 2007 or 88, sorry, and it's not going to work. So I really want this book to show that actually it can happen, even if it's not easy and it's not certain, but it can happen. And I want them to support the cause, because support is really needed more than ever. And you cannot convince people, you cannot engage people into supporting a cause if you are pessimistic and saying that, you know, it's going to fail. So I really wanted to end up the book with a positive note and a message of hope, yeah, so that people want to support it.
Yeah, and so with that, on that note, I want to talk about your title, Breaking the Cycle. I imagine I want to talk about what you mean by the cycle of it, and also that, like, there is the cyclical nature of different coups and different resistance, and every time Myanmar people go through resistance, they are praised for being resilient, and they are not. It's not because they have any other choice. And with the cyclical nature of the coups and then a different revolution, this is one of the latest one. And the title, Breaking the Cycle, give me hope that we don't have to keep facing another cycle of coups, another cycle of resistance, another cycle of war and suffering. I want you to explore on why you chose this title.
So there was this reading, of course, about the different coups and different demonstrations, even in the 70s with the students and, you know, the funerals of the UN secretary, 88 and so on. And every time there are demonstrations and they are repressed and that's it. And for 10 years, we wait for the next one. So that's one of the readings, of course, saying that finally it's possible that this is the last time. And after that, it will be a federal democracy. And finally, that Maduro will lose. So hopefully we can break this cycle. One of the themes also that is important in my book is, you know, racism or xenophobia or mistrust between populations. So not only, I mean, there's a part taking place in Cambridge, for example, about racism in the Western countries, but racism and also the colonization. And from this followed the racist system implemented by the military regime, and all the mistrust between ethnic groups and the Bamas, or within ethnic groups even. So I hope that this cycle, now that, you know, there's one common goal, can also be broken. I know that if you speak with Kayin or Chin people, Kachin, a few years ago, and perhaps still even today, still, I don't know, but they thought that all Bama people were basically supporting the Tet Mado and they were bad people, and Myanmar and Bama people, because of the brainwashing or propaganda, some of them, they thought that ethnic people, they are, you know, fighting to break the country and so on. I hope that now everybody sees that basically all civilians, and I mean everybody except the Tet Mado, they are the same victims and of the same system. So I hope that it will be also a cycle that can be broken. And basically, even if it's a federal democracy, it's a united nation, a nation willing to live together with the same values and the same objectives. So this is one of the cycle as well. And then also there's what we mentioned before, the cycle of violence against women, the gender issues. So basically there are different things that hopefully this spring revolution can finally solve. I hope that also the violence against women will cease or at least be reduced, and we can talk more openly, which started after the transition. We started to talk about gender issues and place of women, or even gay, LGBTQ, and so on. So I hope that these, we have to keep also and respect all values and traditions, but not when they say that women are under men, or that some communities should be pursued or repressed and so on. So I hope that finally we can also find a modern Myanmar with traditions, but good traditions that are kept, and some of them perhaps they need to be changed. Yeah.
I share the sentiment that the conversation needs to continue regarding different issues that were usually put aside. Oh, these women issue, these gender equality issue, we'll talk about it when more important things are being done, like when we have food to eat, when the war is over. These are the conversation that I grew up hearing, not in a argumentative way, but it was just the status quo of how things are. So I do also hope that these conversations continue. So when you mentioned that when you wrote this book, what kind of audience do you have in mind? Is it the Burmese audience who are already familiar? Are you trying to entice a different kind of audience to be interested in Myanmar issue?
It was quite difficult for me to choose, actually, because again, I don't have to convince Myanmar people to be interested in the topic. I hope they will read it and enjoy it, I mean, in a way. And if they will find the first novel about the Spring Revolution, and they will find it interesting. But at the same time, I really want, you know, to reach readers who are either interested in Myanmar, but they are foreigners like me. They don't know everything about it, or they've been here as a tourist, or it's just an interest, or people who don't know anything, but since they are, you know, like history buff, interested in World War II, or interested in political subjects, topics, they will become interested in Myanmar through this lens. I tried to find a balance where I wrote a book with details and information about Myanmar in order to really, you know, explain in details what's happening and the complexity of the situation. So that Myanmar people first, they would think that I didn't write, something that is false, or that I didn't misrepresent the situation. I didn't forget important things. But at the same time, it was very difficult to talk about everything that is going on without going into too many details. At one point, I had to remove 25% of my book, basically based on advice from advanced readers. Because there were too many details about, you know, the different ethnic groups and different places and different synergies or, the cooperation between which group and which and so on. And people didn't know Myanmar told me, oh, it's too complicated. There are too many acronyms. We don't understand who is who. Yeah. So I had to make it a bit more simple. So it was hard to find a balance between making it okay to read for people who don't know Myanmar, understandable, and also being detailed enough, and so that the situation is written in a way that doesn't make it too simple, you know, simplified.
Yeah, I think that's our wish, that Myanmar issue is as simple as other issues that are headlining our news, because when people are talking about Myanmar issue, they don't know whether they should be for or against. They, you know, I would probably compare it as like a Uber or like a taxi driver conversation you would have, or elevator conversation with somebody, and you pitch about, oh, you should support the people of Myanmar, and somebody would mention, weren't they just trying to prosecute Muslims? Or, so those kind of things pop up quite often in my day-to-day life. I live in Washington, D.C., which, you know, to be honest, it is probably one of the most well-informed place about Myanmar that I could possibly be outside of the country. I meet people who are well versed in the Burma policy as much as me. And when I went to my baby's daycare and drop off and chit chat with the parents, talk about Myanmar issue, they understand foreign policy and the things that are currently happening in Myanmar. So I don't take that for granted, and it is one of the places. And yet, sometimes when you hop on an Uber or, you know, meet somebody and they would say, oh, I know Aung San Suu Kyi, but wasn't she bad? Is in Myanmar, you know, don't they deserve it? Or sometimes things are, I guess, the eagerness from the foreigners or outsiders to make it simple, like make it quick. Am I for or against? So you're taking on quite a challenging position to explain it to foreigners who are new to Myanmar issue. And I hope this book can be an introduction into caring and learning more about the Myanmar issue.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, for me, if I wanted to oversimplify, I would say that people should basically see the Tatmadaw like an invading force, an invading army. When you see, even if it's, of course, not true, but it's not very different from Ukraine with Russia in a way. When you see the level of support that Spring Revolution has among the population, even if there's a part of the population that supports Tatmadaw, but it was the case with the German army in France, for example, when they occupied France. So I would say that if we want to simplify it and make it easier for people to understand, the Tatmadaw is in invading force, occupying army, and basically the population is trying to get rid of them to implement democracy. And of course, after that, you have so many other complex things. We can talk about Aung San Suu Kyi, the Rohingyas, etc. But it's the same with World War II in a way. You know, if you want to people to be interested in a topic, you have sometimes to oversimplify. And yes, World War II was the good guys against the bad guys. But when you read into the details, you hear about the rapes by the GIs in the liberated countries, even France or other countries. You have the Russians, which were at one point liberators, but also they killed as many Jews as the Germans, and so on. So nothing is simple. And of course, Myanmar cannot be simple. It's, human society is a complex system. But if we want people to support, sometimes, unfortunately, we have to make shortcuts. And I would say that the shortcut is that Maduro is an occupying force, and they have to go away so that democracy can be implemented.
I totally agree with you. I know we talked about the difficult scenes for you to write, but on the flip side, on the more happier note, what are the scenes that you most enjoyed writing about?
I had a lot of fun writing about the dialogues between the women at the CDF camp. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to show, my wife is Burmese, so I know that there's a lot of conflict between generations and how women should behave. So yeah. I took a lot of pleasure in writing actually about these young women being modern, being open in terms of the vocabulary and what they are talking about, sex and so on. Because I know that basically it's not what Burmese women are supposed to behave, extra. So I wanted to show something a bit different from the clichés, of the traditional Asian girls that tourists can meet. I wouldn't say, because most of the book is not very fun. So I wouldn't say that I took a lot of pleasure in writing most of it, but it was more like a hurt. I really needed to write that, to talk about that, after the coup, after reading everything, after witnessing some things, I kept that bottled down actually, and I needed to talk about it. So it was more like therapy in a way. And there are very few parts of the books which I took pleasure writing, because it was fun actually. Apart from this part, for example, yes, that's it. This dialogue, a few dialogues perhaps. With characters that, like the soldier Pete, I took pleasure trying to find his right voice and writing the way he spoke. But otherwise, it was more like a need I felt to write. Yes.
Yeah, I remember I know the conversation you were talking about. The girls are teasing her about her friend and how they could. Are they romantic or are they not? And the going back and forth on it, the conversation that the women have, it's similar. But I left Myanmar when I was 17, so it's as much as I can remember it. The generational gap, or I think it's like people will call me old in Myanmar now, because it's a different decades after I have left. So the way that I talk probably is different than the Gen Z Burmese young women that they talk right now. And I love that I get to see a peek into it through your book.
I think that if I had to write something now, I probably try to, not in a future book, I would probably focus more, but also this generation gap, as well as the gap between people living abroad and people in the country. I know that now there's a lot of Myanmar people in different countries who feel frustrated because they have a lot of pressure from their parents to send money and Everybody yeah. knew nothing that just because they're abroad, they have they are living the good life and it's very easy, which actually it's very not the situation yeah. for most of them. And so I know, for example, also that the young generation is calling the old generation the Guizzi generation. I mean, there are different kinds of conflicts like this, and it's a very interesting topic. And there could be a lot of fun writing about that, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good next book idea. Yeah. I want to ask you, how has writing this book changed you?
I will tell you after it's published and how it's received. But I would say that writing it brought me some, not I wouldn't say peace, but, you know, I left in 2021. For many years, until I started to write it in 2024, I felt very bad because I wanted to do more. I wanted also to, I didn't know how to express what I was feeling when I was, watching what's happening in Myanmar, watching videos and so on. And it was very emotional and very difficult. So I feel a little bit relief. In a way, because I managed to basically say what I wanted to say, what I felt with this book. But, there are so many other things I would like to talk about regarding Myanmar. But at least, it's like finally something is out. And we'll see how it's received. So hopefully it's going to be something that can bring some support to Myanmar. I would feel even better, of course, if thanks to the book, people are starting to donate and to support and to speak about Myanmar.
I want to know what kind of impact you hope to achieve by releasing this book. You mentioned a little bit earlier that, people might take more interest in Myanmar, which could lead them to donate more. What other impact are you hoping to achieve by releasing this book?
I don't pretend that it's going to change much to the situation. I just hope that this is my wish that everybody, I have Chin friends, Kachin friends, Kayin friends, extra. So I really hope that everybody will see that thanks to the book or there's a common objective. Everybody's fighting for the same thing, and I really hope that it's going we're going to see more coordination and to make sure that there's no fragmentation. That's one thing, but not because of the book. I don't pretend that it's going to change anything, but I hope it will. People will feel the same as I do, that finally there's one common objective and everybody should be behind it, and indeed they feel the same. But what I really hope for is, now we can see, even if, of course, I think that a U.S. intervention in Iran, for example, would probably be a very bad idea. We know what happens when they do something. But, for example, everybody talks about, now we talk about Iran, which is basically facing what Myanmar faced in 2021. We talk about Ukraine. Talk about so many things, but nobody talks about Myanmar. And this is frustrating because I really, really don't understand why. I hope that this book that can at least get some traction and that some people will start at least talking about Myanmar. There's, fatigue also regarding donation, because for now, until now, the support was mostly brought by the diaspora and the Myanmar community abroad. USAID has been cancelled, so it's very damaging. It's terrible. So I hope that also, it's a small book. It's not a bestseller or Pulitzer Prize. I don't pretend it's going to change all that, but I hope that we can see in the future more support from international organizations or countries or governments I mean, for the Spring Revolution, for the Myanmar people. For example, I mean, I'm really worried about, you know, the protection status. I mean, I don't know the exact term for...
temporary protective status.
Yes, for people in the U.S., for example. I mean, I don't know if this book can change anything about that, but if people understand that these people, if they lose this status, they're going back to Myanmar, they will be arrested, tortured, or more. I'm not a famous author, so I don't think it's going to have this impact, but I hope it can contribute at least a little, yes.
Yeah, I recently did an episode about temporary protective status. So if our listeners want to read more about what's happening currently in the United States and about that, and from that, I want to ask you, like, what's your plan for the publishing of the book? Where are they? When can our listeners find this book? How can they read it? Is it going to be available and internationally? And also, is it going to be available in Myanmar as well, given that it is written about the Spring Revolution?
So it's going to be published like any other book. So, of course, on Amazon, but also it will be available in libraries. I don't think that all libraries will order it, but at least if people go to a library and ask for it, it will be possible to order it anywhere in the world. I mean, except perhaps in some countries like Russia, China, North Korea, and probably Myanmar. So Myanmar, I'm actually discussing with some people to translate it in Myanmar, in Burmese, but it's not going to be available, I'm sure, in the Yangon bookshops, but I hope it will be made available on social media, it will be shared and people can read it in Burmese, in Myanmar, yes.
Yes, thank you. I really hope our listeners will get a chance to read your book and find enjoyment in it as much as I did. And thank you so much for giving your time to speak more about the themes in the book and also for writing about Myanmar and not through the pitiful eyes or not just a charity case, but also writing it in the way and showing the truth as it is. And also make it so entertaining and enjoyable with a comprehensive storyline so that people who already know about Myanmar or who are new to it could be immersed in the story and also learn about the situation in the process.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode. As regular listeners know, we often remind our audience about our nonprofit mission, Better Burma, at the end of a show. Truth be told, fundraising is hard work, and I can personally attest that it's no fun at all to keep asking for contributions. But the reality is, the situation on the ground continues to be distressing, and our work would simply not be possible without your support. What helps us most at this time are recurring donations. This provides our team with a reliable foundation, and it helps to reduce the stress of this constant fundraising. This also allows us to focus more energy on creating impactful content for this podcast, as well as to better plan sustainable humanitarian aid to vulnerable populations. Even a monthly pledge really helps. Like, say, gift us the equivalent of, a cup of coffee each month, or consider us a streaming service that you subscribe to. Anyway, to support our cause and make a lasting impact, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation. Oba yarananda dayananga na yarananya dayarananga podaba yarananga no dadiya.